Welcome to Together Equal Diversity Made Simple, hosted by me, Sarah Ebmash.
And me, Andrew Milne.
We'll be talking to guests about how they're working towards making the world more diverse, equal and inclusive. I'm excited to introduce today's guests, Rosie Scott and Poppy Levison from the Disordinary Architecture Project. The Disordinary team focuses on doing disability differently, and today we're going to hear all about what that means. Rosie and Poppy, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, I just want to say, hey, my name is Rosie. Everyone, but my full name is Roseanne Scott. My pronouns are she, her, and my accessibility pronouns are person with dwarfism. I am partially deaf. I just find that's always quite a good anecdote to express so people know what to call my disability.
Hi, I'm Poppy Levison. I use she, her pronouns, and I am a blind woman. I also have a chronic pain condition and migraines.
Ouch, that sounds awful.
Oh. It's funny that you did that, Rosie, because I was going to ask, is there like a standard or is there a medium where you introduce, like, you know, how pronouns are coming into the zeitgeist?
I never knew of disability pronouns. Basically, my friend Katya, who identifies as they, them pronouns, they introduced me to someone who is also disabled and identifies as they, them. But then also in their email blurb, they also put their accessibility pronouns. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I've never thought about that. Because loads of people get confused with my disability because it's a form of dwarfism. Yeah. And certain people in different types of areas of the world, or even in the UK, some people prefer short person, little person, dwarfism. So I now write it on every email. So I'll always have my pronouns and then my disability pronouns. And then I also usually add like migraines and thyroid, so they have an understanding that my energy levels might be low. And I just find at work, I think it's helpful because if they've not seen me before, and they're not going to act shocked because it's on my footnote, so they know I'm different.
So the Disordinary Architecture Project has been running for quite a while, but it's morphed over the years. It was started by Dr. Joss Boys and Zoe Partington. Joss Boys is an architect and Zoe Partington is a partially blind artist. They came together to start tackling the issues around disability being left out of architecture. And they came at this through connecting architects with disabled artists, as there's a greater number of disabled artists than there are of disabled architects. I became part of Disordinary when I took part in the Architecture Beyond Sight short course at UCL, which is a short course for blind and visually impaired people to get into architecture, which is how I met Joss and Zoe and subsequently have started working with them. And I now run the course I took part in, and I also do a number of other projects with them. This is how I met Rosie. We ran a project called Seats at the Table for the London Festival of Architecture together, but I'll let Rosie go into how she became
I met Joss, funny enough, when I was doing my part three, which is the last qualification you do to become an architect, essay, and I did it on analyzing how students should be taught about disability and architecture and inclusive design. So I actually reached out to Joss because one of their books they did is called like Doing Disability Differently, and I wanted to have an interview with them and have a discussion. And then we ended up meeting for coffee, and then we've ended up just being friends since, really. So this has been since like 2018, I'd say, I've known Joss. And then every now and then, I'm not necessarily working exactly with Disordinary, but I definitely volunteer. So I've done a few like roundtable events, or I've been invited to a few discussion panels, etc. And then on the side of this, I'm a director at Refabricate, which is the Sustainable Waste Reuse Program, which I've worked with Sarah on previously. And it's more based on circular economy, waste reuse and retrofit, which I feel very much sings hand in hand with disability, because we should be retrofitting our properties to be more inclusive. And then the project that Poppy was talking about was called Seats at the Table. So Joss reached out to me, and basically we put together an application together to the City of London, London Festival of Architecture and Future Foundation for London, to do a competition for co-designing equity in the public realm, where we analysed and created a programme for disabled people. So it was by disabled people, because we have disabled people on our panel, so there was 10 of us. Then there was for disabled people, so designing for disabled students, but we also designed with disabled students and artists and architects and built environment professionals. So it was kind of split into several parts, with the main theme being about accessibility throughout. So we made sure that all our programs are accessible. We ensured everyone was fairly compensated by getting additional funding for the Arts Council and the National Lottery. And then we also ensured that we invited SEND, primary schools and mainstream schools to participate. So we went to six schools, three SEND and three mainstream schools to design six chairs, being that they're designing chairs for other people, for disabled people or people with different access needs. So we had some amazing designs from students who are designing chairs for their grandparents with TFL fabric, which Poppy managed to source, which was amazing. And then we also had chairs that were like rocking chair and more sensory based from like SEND schools. And it was really amazing to see, because like when we saw these chairs being interacted by various diversity and different pizza people in the park that they were installed in for the month of June, like we found like different people were drawn to different chairs for different reasons. And it was kind of interesting how each chair was also designed separately and individually. So it was also catered for a broader amount of people, which you don't get day to day. And then alongside this, we worked with a lot of disabled artists and built environment professionals in choosing the site. So the initial site was meant to be, because the whole program was based on Smithfield Design Public Realm, which is where basically there's going to be a public realm development happening in 2026, 2027 with the City of London. But we decided that the initial part that they chose wasn't exactly accessible, which was Rotunda Gardens, because funny enough, the ramp entrance to it was right in front of a car park entrance, which we didn't deem as safe for women with children or any parent with children if it's in a stroller or anyone in a wheelchair. So we challenged the competition brief and said we want to analyse three sites with disabled users in mind to ensure that we chose one that was able to cater for different access needs and then also was safe. But it's been an amazing opportunity, and we're now doing an application with the City of London to create one of the interventions that we created and which Poppy led on.
The memorial to heroic self-sacrifice accessible. Okay. So there was a existing memorial in the park to people who've died whilst trying to save others, which is a beautiful set of Victorian tiles, but they're flat and there's no written version anywhere else, so there's no way of accessing them if you're blind. And also if you're deaf and BSL is your first language, because of the language that's used, it's all quite Victorian, it's quite hard to read. So we ended up getting it audio described, and we did a creative audio description, which is kind of a more new and creative form of audio description, which made it accessible to blind people. And then we also did a BSL translation of it.
And then from that, we've also been doing the application to try and make that more of a permanent installation. And we're also still in discussion with the City of London to potentially come on board to help as like a consultant, hopefully fairly compensated, with the new development for the public realm of Smithfield area. So basically, I think the meat market is basically going to be moved and dismantled. And then it's going to be more of like a market public area space with the relocation of the Museum of London. So that's how we got to know each other.
Lots going on there. So it sounds like you've got several initiatives on the go at once, which, as you said, like must keep you immensely busy. So I've got a question. This kind of stems from when Poppy and I were talking earlier on about the design work when it comes to architecture and several challenges. Now, I don't know if it's the right phrasing to do it, but when you're thinking about projects or when you're designing stuff, is there like a baseline for disability? And I mean, for example, you're designing a chair and disability has such a spectrum that you can't have a chair for everyone. So how do you establish the needs, or, you know, what sort of brief do you get in order to have like a baseline? And I think this is probably more relevant for architecture. When you're designing a new house, what are the specifications and how do you find the happy medium, as it were?
Yeah, so there's currently less rigid specifications when it comes to designing things like furniture. There's some guidance on things like sizes and heights of chairs, which are generally done for everyone. But when it comes to architecture, we have a thing called Part M, which is a building regulation approved document. It's all quite dry stuff if you're not in architecture. And that has been in place since the 1980s, which is a minimum accessibility standard that buildings have to meet. So this is things like having ramps, having lifts, how steep the ramps need to be, how bigger accessible toilet needs to be so that a wheelchair user can turn around and things like this. Unfortunately, the situation we're in with architecture is that most architects view Part M as a hindrance, as something that they don't really want to have to do. And they usually only come to check if their building is compliant quite late on in the design, which means we often have accessible elements tacked on at the end, designed in really poorly. We have architects trying to minimise how much they do, such as trying to put ramps only at one entrance, which will be at the back of the building because they don't like the look of it at the front. And this is all seen as generally quite acceptable within the profession, unfortunately, I think, because there's been so few disabled people in architecture, and disability generally in the population is not something that is seen as big of something that we need to be considering than some of the other protected characteristics. It's still quite acceptable to discriminate against us. So whereas Part M should be an absolute bare minimum accessibility, it's usually the maximum level of accessibility that buildings are designed to. And I think that's something that we talk about quite a bit, is we're actually releasing a document off the back of the Seats at the Table project, which is actually called Many More Parts Than M, which is addressing the fact that disability can be a source of great creativity and joy in architecture, and doesn't need to be seen as some annoying thing to be tacked on at the end. But actually, if we embrace disability, it could be a whole new way of designing architecture. And if we're designing it in from the start, we can ensure that disabled people are having as beautiful an experience, an equitable experience, and a pleasurable experience of a building, rather than the current model, which is, can they physically get in the door somehow, but we won't think about how nice it is for them. Whereas for everyone else, we think about how nice a building is for people. With disabled people, it's, can they physically get in the building? Okay, well then the council will let it be built.
Does it mean requirements? Yes or no? Yeah. That's it, really.
That publication, what we're doing, is going to hopefully be launching in end of January in Manchester, and then in February in London. It's hoping to be a public document that people can see online for free. But then also we're going to be printing off a series of free copies. And then also, I think people can request printed copies that we paid for, because obviously the free copies come from the funding that we got. In terms of answering again your question, there is other documents, but those documents aren't necessarily compulsory, let's say. And there's the British Standards 800 document, which is a lot more detailed than Part M for building regulations, because Part M building regulations does reference British Standards 8300. And then the other one is, because I've got 5 years experience background in healthcare environment, so there's the health building notes and health technical memorandums, which are a lot more detailed on accessibility, and they go more into different types of disability, not just wheelchair users. And they, like, when I design now, based on my experience from using those documents, because they get updated regularly, I use those if I am able to, if the client is allowing us, because sometimes, yes, it can cost more, because that is the detriment of the project, is that sometimes to be more accessible, it will cost more. But until it's made compulsory and a necessity that they have to make it, people are going to choose the cheap option. But also in regards to what you were saying, there is no right answer. And I think that was the beauty of the project. When we had Seats at the Table, there was an element that we accepted mistakes, we accepted feedback, we accepted the fact that we were not going to get everything right. And we very much took that as like the whole precipice of the project. It was all about a learning experience. So my answer would basically be, like, you have to design for variety. Like, you can't have 6 chairs all the same.
Yeah.
You need to have different types of chairs, just as much as we have a different chair for a child or for a baby. You also need to have different types of chairs for different types of sizes. So whether that's like people who are large or fat, like, but also I need to be aware that people need to make sure that being fat does not mean unhealthy. Like, I follow a lot of fat activists who are amazing, and they are incredible, like yoga and dancers, like, who are incredibly fast and a lot of a better stamina than I do. And it's just, we need to just cut through the propaganda and media portrayal of disabled people and types of different bodies, because it is different. And we need to design our furniture, everything that we use day to day, and our houses to just be as accepting. We can't expect that everyone is average height. Like, both Poppy and I, like, on a day to day, just leaving the house or even living in a rental property, you face adversity. You have to kick around stools every day. And then, like, just going out to use, like, I don't know, going to the shop, you have to reach something and you have to ask for help. Like, it's just designing for variety. There's never going to be a right answer, and we're never going to have an environment that is going to be totally accessible, because there will always be different types of disabilities, especially when you get a lot of people who become disabled later on in life. Because, like, I think a majority, I think, I don't know percentages of people become disabled at a different time, whereas I'm disabled all my life, and I think that's, like, from what I understand, a smaller percentage than being disabled. And then we're also in a population that's continuously getting older, so therefore we're continuously going to get a form of disability. People might not identify as disabled, but getting older, whether it's Alzheimer's, dementia, or lack of mobility, or slow mobility, that is a form of different access requirements, and we have to start designing for it.
No, and so I live in Manchester, and I kind of look out for, I know it sounds odd, but look out for the accessibility factor. But, you know, you've kind of got the tram network, which gets you into city centre. And then once you're there, it's all steps into this building, steps into there. The pavements are narrow, or they're, like, so uneven.
I'm from Manchester originally, and the cobbles are a nightmare for wheelchairs. Oh.
They're a nightmare when you've got normal shoes on, or, like, flat shoes on. So I can't imagine. I said they're a nightmare when you've got shoes, regular shoes on. So
like, I can't imagine what it's like having to go through it. A wheelchair or mobility scooter sometimes when she's in a lot of pain. And when she's going over, we have to literally plan our journey around cobbles. Yeah. Because going on cobbles causes more severe pain and triggers pain that will then increase the amount of pain that she experiences for the next 3 days just for going on cobbles. So we actually literally plan our journeys when we go out into town to not go through cobbles, and that's not mapped anywhere. So there's certain times that you have to just bite the bullet and you have to go over the cobbles, but it's trying to find what is the shortest distance without, like, the shortest amount of time you can spend on cobbles, because it literally causes my mom, like, so much pain. And it's never really something that's discussed. And at the minute, it's all about, oh, we have to save the streets because it's holistic building or it's heritage. And I'm like, yeah, but if it's not accessible, why are we keeping it? Like, I'm all for retrofit and embodied carbon. But I'm sorry, if it means that, I don't know, if at some point, I don't know, 40 or 30% of the population are not going to be able to use it because the building's inaccessible, it is not sustainable. A form of sustainability is access. Like, you're segregating minority groups in that way if you're not making it accessible. So yeah, I get very, I'll stop because I'll go in a rant, because I get very ranty in these kind of conversations.
I know, we love a rant, so you know, it's absolutely fine. But, like, also on a more positive note, what would you say is, you know, your favourite initiatives that you're working on at the moment?
I think mine is, at the minute, just because of how proud I am of the project from Seeds to the Table. Like, I'm very, very proud of that project. And just because of, like, I hope that 2024 is going to be a big year in terms of disability inclusion, that I'm really proud of the compendium that's contributed to it afterwards. And I'm really excited because there's also been a series of other disabled architects and built environment professionals that have come forward this year that have launched schemes. So you've got Chris Lang, who's developing the British Sign Language for architects, because we don't have sign for certain, like a column. Like, or a beam, we don't have sign for that. So he's creating the language for BSL, which is incredible. And he launched his program this year. Disordinary is doing a load. I know I'm also, like, trying to start spearheading next year off the back of another More Parts Than M. Sorry, I'm getting my words confused. Where I'm still deciding on the name. I've been talking to Poppy about it. It's either kind of Access Collective or Access Collective Community, where I want to create a publicly funded platform that can highlight successful adaptations within the home. So the idea being that we would have a series of A4 spreadsheets where people who have different access needs and disabilities can input and send us what is successful, what products help them. Because what we seem to forget is, like, being in the UK and being a disabled person is privilege. And I'm fully aware of that, because I've got friends who are in Egypt, and they don't have the infrastructure or the money or the finance to be able to support their own accessibility. So I remember I got contacted through a friend. She wanted help from a therapist, so she reached out on one of these kind of dwarf forums on Facebook, which is one of those things that social media is amazing for in connecting people, about what people do in other countries. And we had a chat on something such as, like, the folding stool that everyone buys in Dunelm for a fiver. Like, she physically can't get that. She could never seen it. Like, it would cost her about 100 quid because of the recession, inflation, export tax and everything. Like, she physically can't buy one. And I was showing her, and she's a 3D designer. So she's someone, if I were to take a 3D, like an A4 page and promote the product, she probably could be something that could potentially make equivalent of in her own country that could then support her own access needs. And then there's the other version where, like, with my parents, because my parents also have dwarfism, acknowledged dwarfism. So I've grown up in a home that's adapted where a lot of people aren't. So the kitchen, for example, whenever we redo our house, we have to think about, okay, when are we going to sell it? Because if we adapt it so much, it's then going to devalue the house if everything has to be stripped out to then sell. So that's also not sustainable. So how do you make this economically sustainable? So for example, people have come up with a solution where you have your kitchen, you build it for an average person, but you raise the floor up and you either put a ramp to the floor or you put a step in. So it basically means that instead of like lowering the kitchen, which is costs more, you have to do a lot more customization to it. But yes, that does suit other people depending on different types of disability. You're then only having to take the floor out when you move. So therefore, it's not going to devalue the house by like 10K because someone's going to have to put a new kitchen in. And people don't think like that when it comes to accessibility. And I think if we're able to think in a different way, where we think about it more holistically, whether it's about sustainability, economics, actual success of how useful it is from lived experience. So these are going to be coming from disabled people. Then I think like that's when I think it's going to be improved. Because at the minute you get like with building regulations part M, I highly doubt anyone was actually disabled that wrote that. Like in it shows. And like the number of people when you do design, for like when you get big conglomerates designing, I just feel like you have enough money and space, and whenever you have projects, there's something called social value and section 106, where you have to do a contribution to the community. Reach out to a disabled community and actually get them to involved and compensate them fairly to get them involved on your projects. But it's not just within the architectural industry, it's in every industry. Like just as much as you include pride networks for the LGBTQ plus community, just as much you include minority groups for ethnic diversity and inclusion. It should just naturally happen, and because that will just make a massive change. And it will also help disabled people get into the workplace, especially with how they're currently changing the government rules that we now have to work in order to get compensation to support our accessibility needs when it comes to personal independent payment.
I think for me to go to a non-disordinary project that I'm also involved in, because Rosie's mentioned one of the big disordinary project for this year, I'm a young trustee of the Architecture Foundation, and we're currently carrying out research into inclusive play spaces, because they're shocking statistics around how many disabled children lack access to play spaces, and then that creates further division between them and their non-disabled peers. A lot of disabled kids end up getting injured at parks because the parks and playgrounds aren't accessible to them. So we're working on some guidance, which we're co-designing with a lovely group of fellow architects in London that have got a lot of experience in designing for children. And we're also going to be engaging with lots of kids and disabled kids in creating a guidance document, so that if you're going to design a playground, there's at least some sort of questions and prompts and things to consider, so that we can try and make sure that disabled kids are being included. And this was inspired off of the Let's Play Fair campaign by the charity Scope.
Brilliant. You're doing so many amazing things to change the future. And it sounds like make some movement about what's happening around the world now, so really impacting on society and everyday life. How do you measure success from everything that you're doing?
That's a hard question. One of the things I'd find maybe slightly different, like with Refabricate, that I found interesting. So we launched in 2018, and it's only in the last year where like I got invited to do a lecture on inclusive design within MACE. So I'm trying to come up with an inclusive design client offering within MACE as well. And I've been working with the social value team. And I got invited to do a lecture, which I've had to postpone because of COVID, you know, fun times, to do a lecture. And it was funny. And I mentioned like, oh, yeah, I'm also a director at Refabricate and stuff. And two of the lecturers was like, oh, I know Refabricate. As if it was like another practice. And I wouldn't necessarily say that was a measure of success, because a measure of success for me would be if people were using what we taught them or the workshops that we provided were being implemented. But it did feel like a form of success in the fact that there was a form of recognition and that we are known in a wider scope, probably within more so in the construction industry rather than like everyone. But I think it would be definitely, in terms of success in general, it's when these kind of ideas are just become normal, in inverted commas, and it's not that we have to be the people who face adversity are the ones that are having to champion it all the time, because that is where it just gets exhausting and you do feel like a broken record.
Yeah, I think like Rosie, it's quite a hard one to manage because in some ways I'd say being busy feels like a mark of success, you know, being asked to speak on panels, being asked to give lectures and talk to architects about this. But I'm always hesitant with that because obviously I'm aware that these things kind of come in trends and can easily taper off. But I think what feels like a success to me is the number of non-disabled architects who are starting to care about this. You know, the sad reality is that it's mainly been disabled people, mainly, not all. For example, Joss Boys, who founded Disordinary, is non-disabled or wouldn't identify as disabled herself. I think it's when we get that allyship in a way that we've seen with other protected characteristics groups that you get a real supercharge to the movement because you have so many more voices talking about a thing. You have, we're currently in a position where there's so few disabled people in the room in architecture that it's rare to have a disabled person in the room for every meeting, every conversation. And so it's so easy to leave disability out. But if we can make sure that we've got an ally in every room and in every conversation, then suddenly this is going to be taken on and people aren't going to accept people questioning whether we should have a ramp or trying to cut costs because it won't be socially acceptable anymore. And so I think for me, the success has been when I've had non-disabled architects coming to me and saying, I'm not going to stand for this anymore. I didn't know how big an issue this was, or I didn't see it in that way. I didn't see it as the discrimination that it is. And actually, I'm not going to tolerate it anymore, and calling people out, because the nature of disability is that we already have so much stacked against us. A lot of disabled people struggle to get jobs. We're generally more likely to be in poverty. We have health issues, we have pressures on our energy and time. And so it's that bit harder again for us to then have to do so much advocacy work. So the more non-disabled people that we can also have shouting and taking some of that pressure off of us means that hopefully the movement will just, yeah, be supercharged.
Brilliant. Yeah, I think you're doing a really good job. Sounds like you're doing a really good job as well of building that awareness and getting everyone talking about it, getting those allies on board. And I think it's very easy for people not to think about other people. So, and then to suddenly have that aha moment, you kind of go, oh my goodness, there's this whole, the world that I have and perceive is totally different for a significant proportion of society. So while I think that a ramp might be ugly at the front of a building, actually there's a massive beauty about a ramp because it means accessibility and opening my creation to the whole world rather than a proportion of it. So yeah, I think long may you spread the word and change the world. It's amazing.
I think, like, just on the back of that, just because I feel like we have to pin it and we always talk about it, me and Poppy, especially when it comes to the importance of allyship, is that when you're a disabled person, you have to think about crip time, which is like an American terminology, or spoon theory. Like, as a disabled person, we don't necessarily have the same levels of energy day to day as an average height person or someone without any form of disability or accessibility requirements. So sometimes it's a balancing act. So sometimes, like, as much as we want to do all these kind of interviews and be there in the space to ensure accessibility to people with disabilities are heard, we may not have the energy for it, or we have to make a compromise in order to have the energy for it. Because a lot of the time, like, especially for me, a minute more so with experiencing long COVID, like, the way how spoon theory works is that you say, like, you have 10 spoons a day, but you to get up, have a shower, go to the bathroom, brush teeth, etc., get out the door, that takes 2 spoons, and then going to work takes 3 spoons, and then feeding yourself takes a spoon each time. So by the time you've finished at the end of the day, you might have 1 spoon or no spoons. But, like, especially at the minute when you're dealing with, like, long COVID, I'm waking up and I'm already on, like, minus 15 spoons. So I'm on a spoon deficit. So it's allyship. It needs to come in a form that is also being aware that as much as you need to bring up and break that glass ceiling to make sure people with disabilities are in the room, it's also you need to be aware that you also need to make a compromise to also stand up for them, because we can't be everywhere. There comes a point where disabled people, especially, you have to look after your health first. You have to put self-care first, otherwise you burn out, like, 100 times faster than anyone else.
100%. I think that might take us on to quite nicely to our final question, which is, what could our listeners do differently to make the world properly disordinary.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a lot of the things we've been saying. I think we've all become quite familiar with being an ally for different movements, which is amazing. And when I compare disability to other minority groups, I never want to be that person who plays minority top trumps. It's not ever that we think, oh, they've got it so good. But it's this thing that we need to not forget disabled people. And that also is acknowledging like the intersectionality of being disabled, being a woman, being gay, being black. And there are people who have all of these things. And that's why we need to be considering. So often people will create lists of like, we're trying to improve racial diversity and sexuality and gender in our company, and they'll just completely leave out disability. And I think the biggest thing that people can do is always remember disability. Like, if you've got it on your list, it's a step forward, because even if you don't really know what you need to do about it, it's on the list. You're thinking of it. You're thinking, you might go and Google it. You might reach out to someone. You might speak to someone. And it might seem like a really tiny step, but just remembering that disabled people exist is a huge step from where we have been. And so, yeah, I think remembering that your allyship should extend to accessibility. When you see inaccessible environments, you should call it out. When you see disability discrimination in the workplace or in society, you should be calling out in the same way. You know, we wouldn't accept someone being prevented from attending an event or entering a building because they're black or because they're gay or because they're a woman anymore. That would be headline news. We would be outraged. And yet it's still a daily occurrence for disabled people that we'll get turned away from a building because it's inaccessible, or we can't attend an event because it's not accessible. Or, for example, a guide dog user not being allowed into a shop because someone thinks that their guide dog's not allowed in the building. So there's so many forms that disability discrimination has been normalized, and we need to just put an end to that and stop accepting it, because then we can start moving towards solutions.
Yeah, I very much agree with what Poppy's saying. And I think in terms of how you accept that, especially something that we learned on Teach the Table program, is people just need to listen. Because one thing I've noticed throughout my entire life, the people in the room that are also the ones that have been allocated to help you I'm not very good at listening, and you can get quite defensive. Like, if a disabled person is coming to you and asking for help and telling you how you've done something wrong or discriminatory or prejudice, please do not get defensive. Like, 95% of the time, we are not doing it to make you feel bad. We are making it so that it's easier for the next person in the room to come in and to not experience the same thing. Because, like, especially when it comes to my own disability with dwarfism, like, I'm fully aware that someone's experience with my disability is probably going to be their first experience with my disability. So if I get a kid who's staring at me or asking questions to their mom, explain to the child why I'm different. Do not get them to ignore it, because as soon as you got them to ignore it when they're teenagers, they're then thinking it's like the elephant in the room, and they start finding it hilarious and funny because they don't know what to do because they're doing it out of embarrassment. Like, have a conversation with them and just listen to disabled people and they have something to say. Do not get defensive. Do not say but. Do not come up with something, an excuse. You do not have an excuse. Just educate yourself by listening to them, and then if you feel appropriate, ask a question if you don't understand something. And because it's exhausting, like, because even in my own company sometimes I'm having to literally stand up just to prejudice because they're not listening, and then they think oh yeah. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a disabled person coming to you for help for a question. I'm telling you something you're doing wrong. Like, there is no right or wrong answer. I'm telling you what you're doing wrong for me. You can't speak for me. So it's definitely listening and just not necessarily checking your privilege. That's probably wrong. But just checking in with yourself, making sure that you're treating them like a human being and not expecting it to be some full-blown argument or debate. Because it's not a debate about someone expressing their own accessibility needs. That's not a question.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much. So much to think about there. Rosie and Poppy, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. Thanks so much for your time. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in, and look out for our next episode of Together Equal, Diversity Made Simple.